Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 339, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my pal and co-host, Jason Heaton. Jason, how are we doing this week? The second recording this week.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of crazy. We just did this a few days ago, so I'm doing the same as I did a few days ago. It's so funny, you know, we're doing video today because we have a guest who we'll introduce here shortly, but as I'm watching you read the intro, I'm like, I can't believe you and I still have to read that intro off of a page. After 339 episodes. I mean, I could probably do it.
My daughter asked me yesterday, and I realized I have it off the dome. Maybe it's just like a comfort to have it there on the screen. I feel like if I didn't have it on the screen, that's when I would forget
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Right.
But if you asked me out in the wild, or like, you know, we do a live episode at Toronto Timepiece Show this year again. And last year, my mom ran the intro.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So maybe we'll have a guest do it again this year. But if I had to do it, I think I'm pretty confident I could do it off the dome for sure. But we're recording a second one this week. So normally we record the same week that they go live. But my brother is actually coming into town for the first time in a couple years from the West Coast, and I just kind of wanted to not have I don't mind editing it. There's evenings, kids up, that sort of thing. You can find time to edit, but actually scheduling these things can be kind of tough when we've got a lot of running around to do, because he's got a lot of family to see and he'll be using my place as sort of his home base. So I thank both you and our illustrious guest for being willing to record on a Friday. I think it's going to be a really fun episode. We do have a little bit of housekeeping, kind of show notes to get to right here at the top. So the first one is we're still on a push to do several Q&A episodes in the next little while. So if you have a question for us and you're part of the subscriber side of the show, so you can listen to the Q&A episodes, be sure to send in your question to thegreynato@gmail.com. We've gotten a good stack of them, so we definitely have enough to get going, but we'll continue this push for the next little while. We were kicking around an idea of possibly attaching two or three Q&A episodes at the end of main episodes. And I would say Slack is about as divided as you could be on this topic. About half the messages are like, oh, I would love that. And the other half are, no, please don't do that. I like the Q&A episodes. So I imagine we'll end up not changing anything, as is the way when we can't get a consensus. So that is what it is. And then the next one, Jason, you just released something that I think people, if they're not on your Instagram, might have missed. Do you want to hype up a special audio recording while we're talking about recording audio?
Sure, yeah. As hypey as I can get. You know, I'm such a hype guy. Yeah, I mean, for years I've been asked to do an audiobook recording of the novels that I wrote, Depth Charge and Sweetwater. And truth be told, I have recorded chapters in the past. And I also, I might have talked about this in the past, but I solicited some auditions from some professional book readers and narrators. This was a couple of years ago, and I just wasn't happy with the way that went. And then I got kind of in this analysis paralysis phase where my lack of editing skills and just kind of the time commitment and all of that just sort of put it on ice. And I just decided, I had polled my readers of my Substack on what they'd like to hear or see, or if I want me to branch out into audio. And a couple of people requested audiobook readings, you know, chapters and things like that. So I took the plunge and I kind of did a quick and dirty edit in GarageBand as best I could, and added in the theme music for my buddy Oren, and
shout out Oren,
put it out. I'm pretty pleased with it, and we'll see. I'm gonna keep on with this. James, you offered some help going forward, so might bring you in on a few things, and I think it's behind my paywall on Substack. So if you're a subscriber to that one, enjoy. If not, you know, you might want to consider there's like a free trial if you just want to hear my voice yet another time during a week, as opposed to just TGN, you can go over and check that out. But yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think everybody should check that out, especially if maybe you read the book when it first came out and now you get a chance to listen to it on a drive or something. You know, it's that summer driving season, that sort of thing, which could be lots of fun. On top of that, the last thing we've got before we jump into the rest of the episode with our great guest is the Toronto Timepiece Show is coming up. So this is the third week of September this year, the days the 20 and the 21st. Jason and I will be doing a live episode from the show on the Saturday, and we will be doing a repeat of our marathon event on the Sunday night this year. Invites should go out either with this episode or with 340, so check the show notes, and we'll have it there as far as an RSVP link that you can connect to. If you remember the event from last year, we're just doing the same thing again. There is a little bit of a change in that the venue for the show is now quite a bit further north in Toronto, so we've adjusted a little bit of the scheduling to allow some time to travel downtown, but you have a few options of how to get downtown. So Google Map is your friend in that scenario, so be sure to check that out. But we're very excited for the Toronto Timepiece show. Jason's got his flights, so I'll have my my favorite roommate back for a few days here in Toronto. Yeah. And it's going to be a really good time. So, between the live event and also the new award show is now on the Saturday evening. I'm very excited for that as well as a juror, and Jason will be part of the presenting group. So a lot of that is all coming together, but it should be a very fun, very exciting event. So be sure to check that out. We'll include any of the links you might need for that in the show notes as far as getting tickets to the show. And as soon as we have a direct schedule for our live recording, which will be some point on Saturday, we'll be sure to share that as well. Probably just in the coming week or two. So, yeah, that's I think that's all of our show notes. So let's get to some guest intro.
Yeah, let's do it. We are very excited to have our guest on today. It is none other than Neil Brick. You might know Neil from a number of places, from Instagram. He's got an excellent, fun Instagram feed full of great kind of adventuresome photos and good wrist shots. Interesting collection of watches. Neil's a longtime TGN crew member and active member of our Slack crew. Perhaps most importantly, he is actually the director of merchandising for the Citizen brand at Citizen Watch America. It's a position that he's held for the past 2.5 years. He's had over 15 years of experience in the fashion industry. And over the course of that career, Neil's worked with iconic brands such as Ralph Lauren and Levi's. He combines a deep understanding of product, brand, and consumer to drive results at those companies. And outside of work, Neil is a dedicated family man with an amazing wife of 10 years, 2 daughters who he absolutely adores. He's also passionate about movies, photography, and American football. Neil, welcome to TGN. I feel like you're just one of the old, the OG crew here on TGN. We've known you for a long time, and it's been fun to work with you at Citizen the past couple of years, but welcome to the show officially.
Thank you so much. It's like semi-surreal here. As you said, I've been part of the crew and on the Slack, and I've been listening to you guys probably like a year before COVID, before I was even in the watch industry. And I have a distinct memory. It's so funny, of putting up Christmas decorations, like listening to you guys talking about Doxa. And I was like, I got to get a Doxa someday.
Oh, that's great.
So it's a very surreal experience to finally be on. It's awesome.
Yeah, no, this is going to be great. And we don't commonly have on like brand spokespeople. This is a different scenario because, one, we've known you for quite some time, and two, you're quite active on the Slack as part of that community, especially into topics like Jason mentioned with photography and supporting a broader spectrum of watch enthusiasm than just a single brand. So it's an easy one, but I do feel like this is one of those scenarios where we need a little bit of a disclaimer. Neil is not paying us to be on the show. Citizen is not paying us to be on the show. This is just something that we like doing. We've had a lot of great partnerships with Citizen in the past. Wind Up 2 years ago, we had a great event. And that sort of thing. So it was just kind of a natural option while we were looking for guests to start pulling people from the Slack and from our world. And Neil's been a very active. And then on top of that, we have a watch to talk about that Jason and I have rambled quite a bit about, but don't have necessarily the inside track, the inside story, that sort of stuff. So we thought we could combine all of those sorts of topics into a single episode with Neil. So a pleasure to have you on, man. This is a treat.
I love it. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I remember going back a couple of years, Neil. I remember, I knew of your presence. I knew you were a TGN listener. I followed you on Instagram. We communicated a few times, probably, privately and whatever. And then suddenly you arrived at Citizen. Suddenly you were working for Citizen. It's sort of just kind of, I wouldn't say it caught me by surprise, but I was so pleased that you were on the brand side in the watch space. And it's just been fun seeing you at Wind Up, in Chicago, and being on the boat with you last year when we did the Wind Up in a Lake, which we'll talk about this year's event that James and I both missed, but you were there in a little while. But it's exciting to have you on, and we're kind of using this as an excuse to really dig in deep on this watch that James and I are both wearing. But before we kind of get into the nitty gritty on that, what are you wearing today, Neil?
So I think it might be a boring wrist check. I am wearing the 40th anniversary Aqualand. It's the watch of the summer, mixed maybe with the Huckberry Citizen we did. I kind of like alternate between those two, but the Aqualand is like, the gold just is so awesome. I think they did a really good job and the coloration is great. And I love that Woji strap. It just wears so well. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, as you've intimated there, all three of us are wearing the exact same watch today. James has his on the that nylon strap that he's been raving about and that we've recommended on the show and that I have one. And but Neil, you and I are, looks like we're both wearing it on the stock. What did you call this strap, Neil?
Well, I have it on the Amazon, that cheap Woji like Velcro.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. The, okay. The slide right. Through.
Yeah, three so straps, it, three watches.
I got so. It for the Loom Dial.
Did you go with the black one?
I don't
on
have
that?
The black one on it yet. I've put the green one on. I think it matches better than the black does. It doesn't match as well as the Loom Dial does. It's because the Loom Dial is a little darker on the case. So, mm-hmm. But it's passable. And it's a funny story because I was at
it's a great strap
the beach last weekend with one of my friends and his 13-year-old. And it was the first time he saw this watch and he was in awe. A 13-year-old was just like struck by it. And he immediately had to buy it. He bought it like on the spot, which I thought was really cool. And wow. I think the strap was kind of a big part of that, because if it was on the rubber, maybe it would have been too bulky. I don't know. It wears so well on this strap. I love it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I'm super happy with mine. I mean, regardless of whether or not you had done this episode this week or one in a couple weeks or something, I'd probably still be wearing it. Certainly would have been wearing it today. I didn't actually even have to think about it because I just picked it up and put it on when I got up this morning. I've been really enjoying it. And yeah, and we talked a ton about it on the last episode. So
yeah,
it's been a solid piece and a great watch for the summer.
I was actually I was inspired to dust off my OG Aqualand. I've got a 1985 version, and the batteries have gone flat, you know, as they do. The batteries in those things are three tiny little 371 batteries, and a fiddly little case back with all these little screws that either get lost or stripped. But I took it upon myself a couple nights ago to change those batteries and fire it up and sync sync the time and get that up and running. And I was tempted to wear that today. I have it nearby, so it's ticking away. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think, let me just say, I'll give you a lot of credit here, in that I think around about the time you came on at Citizen, I think it was during that time that James and I maybe were more heavily into some other brands and thinking like, oh, we wish Citizen would do more of this and bring that back and do this and that. And then the Loom Dial JP 2007 was available in the US. We really got excited about that. And then I just feel like Citizen's been on a real roll, coincidentally, in the past couple of years that you've been at the brand. Now, you're free to take credit for that on this episode if you want, but I just feel like the brand is just on a really upward trajectory these days. Do you get that sense of momentum?
I do. I think the past couple of years, whether it's because of me or not, we've had a lot of young people enter the brand in the past couple of years, whether it's Citizen, Bulova, FC. I think all the brands are on the upswing, and it's a testament to management to recognize that, you know, we should probably bring in some young blood and tap into this more enthusiast market. We sell a lot of watches, and we were kind of known as a mall brand, which mm-hmm. is fine. I mean, that's how we pay our bills. But I think tapping into the enthusiast community is very important, and having 2, 3, 4, 5 releases a year to kind of speak to those people is really, really important. And maybe they weren't doing that before we got here. So I'm really excited about kind of where we are and where we're going.
I also think it kind of speaks to some of the difficulty, and we've talked about this before, but not only in the context of watch brands, but just in brands in general, where Citizen is a Japanese brand, which means anything they try and do has to be culturally translated for somewhere else. And I think it must be really difficult, like it would be for us, for Jason and I, to try and craft a TGN episode for a Japanese audience, for a Japanese audience, or even a brand that knows the international market really well. It's one thing to bring technology that you know is just useful for humans, like EcoDrive, for example, or like, you know, the work that Citizen has done with Miyota and things like the 9075 and all that. And I think that's easier to understand. But taking something from an enthusiast level is so specific, right? Like, I don't know that Honda or Toyota or any of these great Japanese legacy brands necessarily know, without a shadow of a doubt, what will become crazy popular. Like, did Nissan know that the GTR would become a $500,000 car? at some point in on the, you know, in America. Like it is kind of an interesting thing, and I think it helps to have brands that have these multiple wings where you're able to explain or inform certain cultural footnotes in the States. And then, you know, and I think it probably takes a lot of time and effort to bridge those cultures and find the sweet spots in what is, you know, a huge and varied lineup of watches.
Yeah, I mean, I give the team in Japan a lot of credit too. We're in constant communication. There's new blood over there as well. They recognize the need to have a younger, kind of more diverse train of thought over there. I love my team that I speak to week in and week out in Japan. I love going over there. I love interacting with them. I think our communication is better than ever, if I'm being honest. And the process of kind of working to what we know works our market, what Japan is doing and how we can bring into our market, I think is getting more seamless, which is great to see.
Yeah, I think I remember when we were in discussions with you a couple of years ago about the JP 2007, the Loom Dial Aqualand. And, you know, we were just almost, I think I sourced mine from Italy, and James, I don't remember where
you
got yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they weren't available in the US, but I remember, you know, in this discussion of like, can we get this in the US? And I remember you telling me it's, you know, it kind of runs counter to Citizen's strategy to kind of push EcoDrive as the kind of the main messaging, as opposed to a watch like this one that says quartz on the dial. We're kind of getting away from that. And it was a little frustrating, but I get it. But then your earlier comment just now about embracing more of an enthusiast crowd, I think that has been the real key. And I think that's something that we talk about a lot on TGN is the paying attention to enthusiasts, because although it can be a smaller, you know, minority of buyers as opposed to, as you said, you know, mall patrons, et cetera, it's such an important piece to kind of building that image of the brand. And I think, and also going back to what James was saying about just interpreting things for the American market, you seem to have some level of autonomy when it comes to like choosing to sponsor an event like Wind Up in a Lake, which is such a quirky small event, or do a show like Wind Up for such a big brand like Citizen.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that. I think when you go to Wind Up, we're, I think, objectively one of the biggest brands, if not the biggest brand, in terms of volume. And I think it's really important to show up there. I think the purpose of Wind Up, it's not a big selling show for us, just being frank, we don't sell a ton of watches, but I think the message that we provide is really cool. And to show watches that, you know, a patron of Wind Up wouldn't normally go to Macy's, wouldn't normally go to a Signet group, whether it's Jared, Kay, or Zales. And they can see that, you know, we have some pretty cool stuff, and we also have some cool stuff that we don't offer at those stores, whether it's Series 8 or a Tessa or higher-end ProMaster stuff. So I value the Wind-Up relationship a lot. I think showing our product in that light is very important.
You know, I'm curious on that extension, and you know, not to, you know, rehash the same, but it's something that we talk a fair bit about, the idea that brands have to maintain kind of two worlds. A brand as big as Citizen has to. We talk about this a lot with Omega. Actually, I think, Neil, you and I have spoken about this exact issue, where you want to be a major brand because that's what works. Economy of scale means you can keep your prices reasonable, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you want to have that enthusiast footing. And they're often two entirely different buyers. Like, you know, we push back on brands with 45, 46, you know, very large watches. But that's because that's what the average non-enthusiast is going to immediately still go for. Like, you talk to these brands and they go, yeah, but we understand you may want a 38 of a watch that we make in 44, but the 44 sells constantly. It's like, you know, I think this is something Breitling has shown us for a decade, 20 years, 30 years, something like that. And I have to wonder, like, do you have these conversations where you go, this is a great product for this type of buyer, this is a great product for this type of buyer, and then try and make sure that you balance it out across your lineup?
Yeah, I mean, but to the consumer's credit, I do think everything is shifting down a little bit. We had a watch release a couple of years ago worldwide called Ciosa. It's probably the biggest watch release Citizen's had in the entire company's 100-year history. And it's a 40-millimeter watch. It's become our number one watch, which overtook a 45-millimeter Skyhawk. It's really kind of a breath of fresh air in my point of view, because it's a very, you know, classic looking three hand date sport watch, if you will, at 40 millimeters. And when you look at our demographics, our average size went from like probably 45 a few years ago, and I think it's down to like 43. And that's a 2-point swing is a huge shift in our company. Yep. Our age demographic is also shifting way down, which is amazing. We were above 50 just a few years ago, and now we're below 50, which again, with the size of this company, is a huge shift. I think the watch wearer are... The watch consumer is starting to, you know, not gravitate towards that 47, 48, 46 millimeter. Not that they still don't sell. We have a watch coming out this spring that it's funny because I'm in market right now and it's 48 millimeters. And the buyers are kind of like, whoa, what? And like, well, you know, it's 48, but it wears really well. The lug to lug is about 48. We still have a consumer that wants that large size watch, but 40 to 42 is still very important. And next spring, we're kind of closing the loop on my idea of like, we just celebrated 35 years of ProMaster last year. So what's the next 35 years of ProMaster? I kind of see it, you know, we've really nailed down the large, super spec heavy, quirky ProMaster. Now it's like ProMaster meets kind of like Sport Lux. It's the same spec heavy, you know, can do anything watch, but it has a little more refinement to it. I don't know if you've seen, we had a 40 millimeter Navahawk launch earlier this spring. And then we had the 41 millimeter or 40.6, if you're being exact, dive that came out this fall. And we're kind of closing that circle with a land watch next year that I'm very excited about.
Well, look, that's, you know, lots of business side there. Let's go back to the Neil of it all.
Yeah.
you know, easy starting question, our standard question. What kind of got you into watches in the first place? Like, even assuming you were into it before it became a more of a career path.
Yeah. So I was always kind of into watches. I know I had like fossils in middle school or whatever it was. And then high school through college, I got really into those J. Crew Timex collaborations. Kind of started wearing the NATOs a lot. And nice. I'd wear that NATO to death where it like became just gross. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't wash it or anything. But I really love those like simple white dial field watches. And then about halfway through college, my dad decided to give me his, it's a really quirky watch. It's like a 39 millimeter at a base to Montblanc diver. Has like Breguet numerals. It's interesting. Our Breguet numerals on the bezel. It's a super quirky, fun watch, yeah. But I didn't really appreciate it at the time. And there's a funny story where I was really getting into watches a little bit later and I wanted something, what I thought was like more top tier. So I wanted a Tudor Black Bay. And this guy offered me his original rose dial red bezel Tudor Black Bay for some cash and the Montblanc, and I did it. And like a year or two later, I kind of regretted it. I reached back out to the guy and I was like, hey, would you sell me that Montblanc back? And he's like, no, I love it. I was like, okay, whatever. I put a watch recon alert on it, and they're kind of random, so I never thought I would see it. But when I sold it to him, it was just the watch head, and one came up on bracelet. And so I reached back out to him like, hey, would you trade me the watch straight up with this one with bracelets, the exact same watch, but you get the bracelet now? And he agreed. So I actually got my dad's watch back. So that's pretty awesome. I kind of love that story. And that's kind of my first foray into a watch regret selling kind of movement.
I just dropped a link into the chat there in Zoom. Is this an example of the one you're
meeting? Let me see. Where is the chat?
A Meisterstruck Sport.
That sounds right.
Millimeter.
That's it.
What a cool thing.
It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, hit the show notes. We'll include this link. It's somebody selling one for $361, apparently, on Best Buy, but it's not that Best Buy. Goodness sakes, this website.
So this one is quartz. Mine's automatic because it says automatic on it. Yeah, so if you can see.
Oh, yeah, that's sharp, yeah.
But so it's not going anywhere now. It's like a quirky little watch, but, you know, it means something.
So that was your first serious watch. That was kind of like your high-end, so to speak, or, yeah.
That was the first serious watch given to me. The first serious watch I bought was, it was before that. It was the Hamilton Khaki Field Powermatic.
Yeah.
AD, whatever they call it, yeah. So that was like the first kind of like Swiss watch I bought with my own money. I got really into a Hedel's article, I think, about like Hamilton's past. And I was like, this is really cool. Yeah. And that was really the slipping slope. After that, it was like I went to Laurier, which is not like a high end, but it was kind of a really enthusiast kind of purchase.
Yeah.
I had a Glycine Airman 1.
Ooh, yeah.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
The combat sub is still a sleeper. Underappreciated. Yeah.
Then I got like real deep real fast. I went like Tudor, Black Bay 58, Black Bay GMT. I had P01 at one time.
PL1.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I put a metal bracelet on it, which is awesome.
I think we're very slowly becoming the podcast of record for the oral history of the PL1. Someday we'll find out maybe how many of those they made. But talk about making a niche play that so much of the market and the like coverage of the market did not understand at first glance, at first pass, right?
It's such a quirky, fun watch, and the history behind it is kind of cool. And I don't know, I loved it when I had it. And then I got my first Rolex. I got a 14270 Explorer with trim dial. There's also a kind of funny story with that where I was working at Ralph Lauren at the time, and I got a job offer in February of 2020. It was like my first like big, like a monumental salary kind of a thing. And I was like, I want to get something special. And I got that watch before I started the job. I was supposed to start April 2020. And something happened in March of 2020 where I got a call a week before I was supposed to start. And they were like, yeah, we can't do it. And I had already put my notice with Ralph Lauren. And I was like, oh my God, I just got this watch and now I'm unemployed. But I kept it and I wore it every day during the pandemic before I started working again. And it's kind of the watch of the pandemic now where I got to spend every day with my girls, which, you know, working 5 days a week, you don't get to do. So it has a special place for that reason now as well.
That's great. Well, I think that brings up a question for me, and that is, and we can get into how you got your start at Citizen and your work there a little further, but one thing I've always kind of liked about you and admired about your feed and just chatting with you and whatever is a lot of people, when they go to work for a brand, they kind of get lost in, I don't want to say they drank the Kool-Aid. That's a bit harsh, but you're someone who's appreciative of all brands and have kind of kept your enthusiasm for watches you've had in the past and other brands pretty equally while still being a great champion and ambassador for Citizen as well. Is that a difficult thing for you? Is that or not so much?
I mean, it's difficult in the fact that I can't wear brands to work. So, I mean, if you look at my feed, it is 99.9% Citizen, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. But, you know, sometimes I do miss those Tudors, or I had, the Hamiltons, or I had a Blancpain 50 Fathoms for a hot second. So that was fun. But the Citizen watches that I wear and I post, I don't post just because they're Citizen. I do love them and I have a lot of fun with them and I think they're really cool. And I post some stuff that you can't even get here sometimes. So it's not like I'm trying to sell product. But I still have my 2254.
Oh, great. Nice.
Seamaster. And I have a watch from Ken coming, James, that I met in Chicago.
Hey, there
so
you go.
That'll be fun. I had a Marin for a little bit. You know, I walk wind up as an enthusiast, and I'll talk to them, and you know, I'll usually spend a little bit of money at wind up where I probably shouldn't be.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, how did you get your start at Citizen then? I mean, how did that come about to move from after Ralph Lauren? You said there was that bit of a lull or kind of some time off. And then when did Citizen come on the picture and how?
So after Ralph Lauren, I had a lull, and then I worked for a company called One Jeanswear Group, which is like a private label jeanswear. They do private label for like Belk, and they do like the Jessica Simpson line, whatever. It was an interesting step in my career where I was used to selling premium denim at Levi's that was like, you know, all Levi's vintage clothing and mincrafted that are retailing for, I don't know, anywhere from $225 to $500. And the One Jeanswear stuff I was selling, I was like sourcing product for a dollar and selling it to the brand for whatever it was and out the door for $20. It was a completely different world, which is fine. But it was not something I knew I wanted to do long term. And so I was always kind of looking around at jobs, and I loved watches. I had my Instagram, I had my buddies that, you know, you have these watch group chats, and I was like, oh, I was at watch time and I was like talking to the brands, like, how do you think I could fucking work here? Like, I remember talking to Bill and Ross. And he was very nice. I forget the gentleman's name. And I was like, I wish I could be here next year. And it was just a cool kind of thing to think about. And on LinkedIn, there was a Citizen posting for a sales job. And I applied because why not? And I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks. And I was like, you know what? Let me check Citizen's LinkedIn page to see if I have a connection. And I didn't have any direct connections, but there was someone with the same title as what I was applying for who went to FIT. And I went to FIT, so we were both alums of FIT. And I was like, you know, let's take a shot. So I was like, hey, you have no idea who I am, but we both went to FIT, you know, FIT alum, brother, sister, whatever you want to call it. I would love to just to talk to someone. I applied for this job. Would you give my resume to HR? And she replied immediately and said, sure, why not? So I'm immensely grateful to her. I actually never met her. She was on maternity leave about to start before I started. And then she actually stayed being a mom, which is great. So it was kind of weird. I never even met her face to face, but she gave my resume to HR. I had a few conversations and I applied for the role. And I actually didn't get that role, but the person I interviewed with liked me enough to say to her boss, who kind of runs the sales organization, hey, you should probably talk to this kid. I think he's pretty good. So I talked to her, and on the same kind of timeline, I'm interviewing with a company called Happy Socks, which is, you know, the fun sock brand. And okay. The day of the interview with the person I have the conversation with, I get a job offer from Happy Socks. And I was like, oh, here we go. So on the phone, I'm like, you know, I would never say this normally, but if you think there's any chance you could give me a job, I would probably need to know like over the weekend, which is ballsy of me, I guess. But, and she's like, okay. And I get a job offer from Citizen about 3 hours later. And I come to find out on my first day that there really was no true role. They just knew that two girls were going on maternity and they'll need some help. So I really kind of lucked out in that way. And I started working in the sales division. And my first meeting ever was with the Teddy Baldassare Group, which is like really fun. I thought that was kind of a cool way to introduce myself. And I guess they found out that I had this connection with, you know, the enthusiast group. And because there was no real title for me, they had me doing the Teddy. I was starting to work with Tantan at you guys at Hodinkee. And I was working with the Windup Group because no one had really established that connection. And that was kind of my role, was like, let's figure out this enthusiast market. So that was kind of my start with the sales team. And then to kind of fast forward to where I am now, after about 10 months in the sales role, the director of merchandising who had the job currently, or when I was in sales, had decided to leave. And Susan Chandler, who's our chief merchandising officer, kind of always, I guess, saw me out of the corner of her eye and like, you know, I think he could do product. And she just had a gut instinct. I had never done merchandising before. I've always been in sales. And I talked with her for a few weeks and we thought it ended up being a good fit. And I started in November of 22. Wow. So yeah. It's been pretty fun.
And are you you're specifically focused on Citizen? You don't cross over with Bulova and Frederic Constant and others, right?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So on the sales end, I was all brands. But now with the merchandising, I focus on Citizen. We do sit next to each other. So I overhear and we kind of, you know, we call it the power of one. So we try to help each other where possible. And, you know, we don't want to overlap either. So we know what we're doing on each brand. So we don't want to, like, if you're creating this, we don't want to create something that's identical. We want to keep our brands separate. And we think Bulova and Citizen is pretty easy to do.
I'm curious, you know, I mean, TGN, I'm actually looking, we're on video now, which our listeners won't see, but I see our TGN ProMaster tote bag hanging on your doorknob behind you there. And that was such a great collaboration and great kind of mixing of our logos. Yeah. But I mean, TGN is really all about ProMaster, you know, like I feel like we're heavy into that for obvious reasons. It's kind of our thing. But your work goes well beyond ProMaster. I mean, you're all of Citizen, I presume. And I'd love to hear your recommendations to us and to our audience of if we want to, what's a watch that we're overlooking by being so strictly focused on ProMaster? And yeah, like what's a sleeper watch that you think would appeal to us and to the TGN crowd in Citizen's lineup that maybe isn't ProMaster?
Totally. Well, I think the first kind of low-hanging fruit would be our, what we call, these are more internal terms, but we have pillars within Citizen's lineup. So there's ProMaster, there's Dress Classic, which is kind of like basic stuff. We have Modern, which is kind of like, you know, your museum dial look. But we have something that used to be called Weekender, is now called Sport Casual. And when I present the line, I call Sport Casual ProMaster Lite, because it has all the aesthetic aspects of ProMaster, but maybe not the specs. So, you know, we have like desk divers, we have pilot watches, we have field watches that, you know, there aren't 200 meters of water resistance, maybe they don't have screw down crowns, but they have the look and feel of what maybe a ProMaster would be. They're meant to be worn like on weekends, if you will. So there's a watch called Bryson Titanium that came out last year. It has a bi-directional bezel. It was one of the first watches that I kind of had my fingerprints on. So I'm really proud of that watch. There's a gray dial, an orange dial, and a blue dial on leather strap. 41 millimeters titanium, case and bracelet, milled out clasp, metal dial. So the cool thing about EcoDrive is there's so many different movement variations. There's ring solar, we call it, which allows us to have a metal dial where the light can enter through the ring of the watch, like the chapter ring. And then we have all of our other dials that are plastic that the light enters through the plastic. And next year is actually 50 years of EcoDrive technology. And there's some amazing things coming out next year to celebrate that. But the advancement in the technology is just second to none. And where, you know, we used to have, you know, milkyish white dials, or you could see kind of like the purple through the black. And it's really come such a long way. You can really see that in the E365 movements, which is the new 1 year power reserve. The cool thing about those is not even the 1 year power reserve, I think. It's the, we can have a more opaque dial and we can have heavier hands. So one thing you can notice about EcoDrive 2 is the hands can seem quite stumpy sometimes. And this allows the hands to look more like a traditional watch with a metal dial.
What do you have a favorite Citizen? Like one that you, I mean, just on top of everything else that you either wear the most or that you just, if you had to only choose one, which would it be?
For sure. Are we talking vintage or in line?
Well, give us one of each. Yeah.
All right. So for vintage, I think my absolute favorite is something I can't even like afford because it's gotten crazy. But there's a 1969 Chronomaster 500 meter. Fertello did a great article on this. And I saw one in Japan last year. I think they wanted like $9,000 or something. I was like, I can't do this. But I love this watch. It's such like a cool throwback. It's got the huge Mercedes hour hand. It's got this big chunky look to it. And 500 meters in 1960s is pretty awesome.
It looks like the Fujitsubo, right? It kind of looks like the Challenge Diver.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of that origin to it. And then we did the Challenge Diver about a year later, 10 years later-ish. And that's what really the Fujitsubo is. This is kind of like the first version of. It's really cool. So that's probably my favorite vintage. And then currently, Fujitsubo is up there. I don't wear it as much now because I try to like,
I can't get mine back from my dad.
I love that he loves it.
Adores it. Yeah.
It's so good. And then that line is continuing to some exciting probably moments in a couple years as well with maybe a new movement. So that's pretty cool. Besides that, I think my absolute favorite I have right now is maybe my The Citizen Caliber 210. I got it for my 10-year wedding anniversary last year. It's our higher end line of The Citizen. It used to be JDM only, but I've made a point of bringing everything at least into our .com and flagship. So it's a white dial, has this beautiful dial, integrated sport watch, 100 meters water resistance. It's just kind of like the perfect everyday our version of that higher end integrated sport watch, if you will.
And is that the one on the strap or do you have the bracelet or?
I have the bracelet. Nice. Yeah. They're next level. And I think they're a bit of a sleeper too. And we don't make a ton of them. The movement is, you know, really hand touched. There's one old lady that finishes all of them. That is the nicest little woman in the world that I met in the factory. And she was so cute. She's like, go sell my babies pretty much. She was like, she really takes time and care into each watch. And they really mean a lot.
Yeah, while we're talking about watches, let's segue into this 40th anniversary Aqualand. And I'm curious, the little bit of background that I brought up earlier about getting the Aqualand into the U.S. market in the first place, this relic, this watch that really hasn't changed much since the 80s. What's the kind of the backstory of the move? And are these Aqualand 40s, are they being sold with as much enthusiasm and gusto around the world, or is there just sort of a shoulder shrug of like, well, we've always had these watches. What's the big deal about this one?
Yeah. So like you said, the Aqualand was something that the US market didn't really have in plans to have in the market. I kind of like heat and hawed until we got the Loom dial in a small way. And then about a year and a half ago, I was like, oh my God, it's going to be 40 years in 2025. I'm curious if they're going to do anything. And I reached out to Japan, we had a meeting, and they're like, well, you know, we don't have any movements or anything like that, but, you know, we'll probably do a colorway. I was like, okay, that's good enough. So I started talking to them, and they asked me, like, maybe what we should do in a colorway. And I was like, you know, the black and gold is, like, the coolest version of it. So maybe a version of that. And I think what they came up with the kind of like gray IP with the gold accent really is pretty amazing. And because it's the 40th anniversary, I think it was an easier sell to my management to bring it in. And we've kind of looked at it as almost like this archive version of our website. You know, it's not going everywhere. It's pretty much only on our .com and select, you know, independent field retailers. and it's more of a story play for us. It's kind of a marketing angle, but they are doing extremely well here, more than we probably would even have imagined. And worldwide, they're also doing really well. I think Italy had a really cool activation in, they used the deepest pool. Maybe it used to be the deepest pool because I think Dubai now has the deepest pool, but there's a deep pool in Italy that they did this kind of event over there. And, you know, the Aqualand is still, you know, 40 years, it's still going strong. I think, it's just such a cool, unique watch, and it lends itself to, you know, the 13-year-old saw it for the first time and absolutely loved it. So, that means a lot to me.
Yeah. It's just such an iconic watch. I mean, it's so perfect, in its quirkiness. And, mm-hmm. You know, just this past episode, James and I were kind of talking briefly about opportunities for evolution with the Aqualand, and we both thought that, well, maybe EcoDrive in the future. But I mean, is this watch even worth evolving? I mean, you might almost just keep it the way it is. I mean, it's just, there's no reason to change something like this and keep cranking out other interesting EcoDrive watches, right?
We've had the exact conversations, and still are having the exact conversations of like what should be the evolution of Aqualand. It's such an iconic brand name. And we've had debates whether like the Aqualand watch needs to have an external depth sensor, or can it, you know, not, or is it always Anadigi, or what is the future of it? So we're still tinkering with that. Obviously, James, you had a really good review of our Land U822, which is kind of like our new version of Anadigi. I'm not saying there's an Aqualand with that coming, but I could see that being the kind of like easiest way to maybe bridge that gap eventually. We just introduced a Sky version of that actually like just a couple days ago, which is pretty awesome.
Really cool watch. Yeah, that popped off on the Slack, and I you know, just because I'm keeping a lower level these days with the baby, but I instantly clicked in and was looking around. That thing looks rad.
It's pretty cool, and it wears a little smaller than the Land, so it has a little more like a dressier vibe, but. I'm actually interested in your opinion, because, you know, Pelagos was always kind of like the 500 meter super dive watch, theme escape valve. And then the Pelagos 39, and there was like on this mixed reaction, like, should Pelagos have done this? Is this kind of like too normal dive watch?
Yep.
And then like, so I brought that up, like, you know, could we have Aqualand 2 or Aqualand 40,
yep,
where, you know, you have the main Aqualand with the depth sensor and everything. And then you have, you know, you bring the DNA of aesthetics down maybe to a normal 40 millimeter case or whatever it is, and you leave the depth sensor out. It's still just a really cool dive watch. But I think we had this conversation on the Warren Wellen podcast when I was in Chicago, and they're all adamant, like, no, it needs to have a depth sensor.
we'll be sure to so link to that. That'll be great.
True diver opinions. But I think there could be a place for it. I don't know. We'll see where the future takes us with Aqualand.
Well, I think, you know, for a while there, Aqualand evolved. I think it was in the 90s and early 2000s where we got some strange Aqualands. There was one with kind of an asymmetrical, almost backwards D-shaped case that had...
Yeah, the JP.
And they moved really a lot to this sort of analog representation of depth. And I felt,
yes,
like, I don't want to diss anything from the brand because, you know, I love Citizen, but I just felt like that was a step in the wrong direction to kind of go to analog display of depth, whereas the Anadigi thing was just so user-friendly and intuitive. But I kind of get why they probably moved in that direction. I mean, this is still a very niche, quirky watch, and it probably didn't necessarily fit the direction the brand was going at that time. But it's to their credit, to Citizen's credit, to keep this watch in constant, you know, in the lineup for now 40 years is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I think the analog thing was they were trying to make an EcoDrive version. So some of those analog depth sensors are EcoDrive, which is pretty,
yeah,
cool. But I just don't think they hit the note that the, you know, the original Aqualand does. And to, like you said, I mean, there's not many products in the world, I think, that can go 40 years unchanged.
Yeah.
You know, very few things that are kind of iconic in their look. So it's pretty cool testament to the original designer,
yeah,
of the Aqualand.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that maybe these watches weren't necessarily the most popular, or they didn't persevere, but my first Aqualand was a Loom Dial EcoDrive model with a little tiny hand for the depth that would essentially tell you the max depth once you came back up. And I distinctly remember very, very early on in my sort of watch interest, this would have been 2006, maybe 2007, maybe even earlier than that, I was on a cruise to the Bahamas, and we went on a snorkeling trip out to the reef, and I like the DM, the guy on the boat who clearly was bored because he was a diver and he was just leading a bunch of kids to flip around in the surf. He had like the full fat Aqualand, with the full digital display. It was the JP version with the red. So it had the digital and analog indications. A very cool watch. And I remember being like, maybe he'll notice mine. It had the little ND chart on it. And I kind of wish I still had that watch. Oh, it was really cool. I remember I sold it to buy a Citizen SST, which was like the super accurate, like I think it was a 1/1000th of a second chronograph. And like when you were running that, it spun like crazy. It was a really cool watch. And I was just in that mode of flipping watches to get another watch to write about very, very early. This might even have predated my time with Watch Report. I'd have to go back and check some notes. But yeah, I remember really liking that watch. But definitely thinking like, well, I don't know, how would you read this necessarily? Whereas the digital display, like I had this in the water at the lake last weekend, and you put it in dive mode and just dive down to the bottom, and you can like watch it drop to 2 meters, 3 meters, like however deep you can get. And it's super easy to read, even, you know, with a dive mask and the rest of it. So, I mean, there's pluses and minuses, but I like the idea of there being an ecosystem of Aqualands with these, with the quirky, coolest, you know. We've said this before. This in my mind is Citizen's Ploprof. It's the, you know, if we had a Cousteau today, this, and he was wearing a Citizen, it would undoubtedly be this one. But maybe some of the guys on the boat would, you know, some of the crew hand, that kind of thing, might have something that didn't need all of the features, right?
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I mean, speaking of crew and divers on boats, want to give a quick lowdown on how Wind Up in a Lake went. I mean, we linked out to Chris Soule's story in last week's final notes, so people can read that certainly. But what were your impressions of the outing this year?
I mean, I thought it was really cool. It was a little different than last year, as the article stated. We had a little bit of an audible with, I guess it was like an engine trouble or something like that. So, but I think we all made the best of it. Having the 80s theme was such a cool vibe, and having everyone have fun with, you know, their outfits. And there's a lot of short shorts on the boat, which was really funny to see. But I think everyone really enjoyed it. We had the Aqualand. We had the new 40mm diver. We had the new E365 diver. The dive went really well. I mean, I'm not certified. I didn't go in the water. At a dive aspect, I did swim around. The water was insanely warm.
Oh, nice.
Much warmer than it was last year. I was able to just kind of wade in the water for the whole time. They were down under 45 minutes or so. So that was a lot of fun. But I think the crew had a really good time. And I really love the 80s theme. And I brought a film M6 on board. And that was really kind of cool to capture the dive in film to kind of give it that 80s vibe, which was a lot of fun.
It was so fun to see the pictures. I mean, yeah. It was people really, really, really took it seriously. And
Tom with his painted on mustache was hilarious.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Just great. He's one of a kind. What a dude.
He's awesome. Yeah. But yeah, it was a good trip.
So I'm curious, you know, I, in a past career, I was kind of the American outpost of representing our Japanese crew over in Japan. So I kind of can sympathize with you a little bit on kind of that, the difficulties and fun of working with a kind of a Japanese outreach or whatever. And I'm curious what they think of all this kind of quirky, weird stuff. I mean, do you share the Wind Up in a Lake thing and guys with painted on mustaches and short shorts with them? And they just scratch their heads and think, what are you doing over there?
A little bit, but I think they kind of enjoy it. I think I share as much as I can of what we're doing. And I think they're really valuing it. It's something that, you know, like you said, a couple of years ago, we weren't doing. And, we're doing really well, so maybe they can put two and two together, and you know, this is a reason why we're doing well, or maybe it's not, and it's just kind of a fun way to showcase the brand. That's not, you know, a three-hand dress watch in a mall kind of like sliding visual diagram.
Yeah,
our Promaster line is like authentic dive watches, and then our QC is, I think, second to none. And we really, really value ourselves in how we put together a spec heavy watch. So when we build the watch to spec and we see it in its proper use, I think everyone is very happy about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. That's great. Yeah. It's got to be a source of pride. I mean, these are
100%.
Yeah. It's great. So kind of closing things out on those kind of Citizen discussions, what are you the most excited about in that you can share for the rest of this year and maybe into next year?
Yeah, some more anniversaries coming up, you mentioned.
Yeah, so next year is the 50th anniversary of kind of like our solar EcoDrive technology. It's going to be dubbed like 50 years of EcoDrive innovation. And well, I can't share the exact models yet, but there'll be some really cool limited editions that come out in the back half of that year. It's really cool kind of the first time using some materials in the front half of the year. So I'm really excited about a couple of those things. And the later of this year, no huge kind of releases. There is a variation of Ciosa that will come out later this year that I'm really excited about. So you'll see that maybe in a month or two. But, you know, we're constantly evolving and constantly bringing out, you know, what I think is the right assortment. And, you know, just because it's not for the enthusiast doesn't mean it's not really cool. You had mentioned some sleeper watches, or one I did want to mention too. It's the Rollin. We just introduced it on Bracelet, and it's a 5-link bracelet. There's a root beer colorway that is amazing. It's the brown and rose gold and stainless steel. Really, really cool. There's a blue dial stainless steel option. This is kind of like my first foray into really making ourselves, you know, a little unique into the dress classic category. So, you know, there's if you're only looking at a ProMaster product, please, you know, look at the whole line in general, because, you know, just because it's called dress classic or sport luxury, we still try to make everything as cool and unique as possible.
And yeah. we'll include a link in the show notes, of course. But if you're listening, Tsuyosa is Tsuyosa. If that helps, if you're sitting yes. at your desk and are Googling around for that word, that's a strong pronunciation of a word that's a little bit misleading in the way that it's spelled. So, but those are great looking watches for sure. How about some final notes? You want to dig into everyone's picks for the week?
Yeah, let's do it. Neil, what you want to take the honors and take the first one?
This is a good one.
Speaking of anniversaries.
Yeah, speaking of anniversaries, I'm a big movie fan. And Jaws had their 50th anniversary this year. And one thing I thought was really cool I did was on like the anniversary weekend it came out, I put a projector out by my pool and we watched it on the pool. So that was kind of fun.
Awesome. Except you broke your toe, you said.
Yeah, I think I broke my toe. I don't know. Well, it might have been just a really bad stumping, but it hurt for a couple of weeks, so yeah. It might have been broken.
Yeah.
But it was all part of the process, right? So, a part of the anniversary is Disney Plus and Hulu came out with a Jaws at 50, the definitive inside story, and it's an amazing documentary. If you don't know, the production on this movie was very difficult. The shark rarely worked. There's a really cool Broadway or off-Broadway play called The Shark Is Broken that is really, really cool. It kind of gives another inside scoop onto how each actor kind of dealt with waiting for the shark. But hearing Spielberg's side of it, Spielberg reaching out to the Blue Water White Death kind of dive team is really cool to hear. That was kind of fascinating that, you know, he wanted live footage of a great white and he went to the right people. So it's just a really cool, interesting story. I'm not sure if either of you have seen it yet, but I really loved it.
I haven't, but that's great. I mean, it reminds me when you mentioned the difficulty of production of the Hearts of Darkness, the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now. I think these films that we now look back on as just such classics, some of them had such fraught histories of their production. And I'd love to see this one about Jaws. And your mention of that play on Broadway, I think that was Robert Shaw's son, Ian, I think is his name. And he mm-hmm. acts in it, or he wrote it or something. But yeah,
he did both.
I'd like to see that as well. That's really cool. Did you see it?
We did see it. Oh. I saw it like on when it first came out before it kind of like became hyped up, I think. My wife was really cool. And I think it was my birthday present 2 years ago. And she knows I'm a big Jaws that's fanatic. Great. And I'm so happy that she was able to do that for me.
It's a funny thing because I think people forget one, and I'll give credit to Rewatchables. They have a great Jaws episode. If you want to get another mm-hmm. side of the oral history, I don't think it's going to be as complete as what's in here because so much of Rewatchables is just kind of a fun convo. But Spielberg was 27 when he made that movie.
Wow. It's crazy.
Wow.
And it's like I've been showing. Speaking of Spielberg, you know, my daughters love E.T. I don't know if you've gotten there with your daughters, Neil. I think they're a little younger. And then recently, I took my daughters through the entire run of Jurassic Park. And that's when awesome. You tell them, like, no, the same guy made E.T. that made Jurassic Park, they go, like, how do you, that's a lot of good movies. I'm like, he's got about 25 more that people really, really genuinely love.
Incredible.
So we went and saw the most recent Jurassic Park, which is Jurassic World Rebirth. It's now another storyline, a different, same timeline, same world, different storyline, different main characters, that sort of thing. And, you know, the movie was, you know, it's not the first one, and I still have a soft spot for the second one because of how old I was when it came out, and early Vince Vaughn and the Mercedes ML launched with it and all these cool things. But I digress, of course. The interesting thing here is we're sitting waiting for the movie, and they have like a, they're going to do a screening of Jaws for the 50th anniversary. And I don't remember the last time I saw it look that good. So I'm kind of sitting there with my jaws, you know, jaw on the floor watching this Jaws trailer. And both of my girls are like, is this that the same? That's real Jaws? It's in the theaters? It's a new one? I go, no, this is the one from 50 years ago. And they're just getting to the point, like we watched Sandlot this last weekend, where they can tell like a movie made earlier versus now. And they're a little bit sensitive to that. And they're like, wow, that looks really good. You know, is the shark animatronic? I go, it is sometimes. Sometimes it just sat in the water.
Yes.
So I can't, that would be, I think that one would cross the line as far as, you know, appropriate things to show my young daughters. I like trying to push that limit a little bit, but I don't, and I don't want them to be scared of water or sharks.
Yeah.
So we can wait on that, but definitely when we get to it, we'll also watch this documentary. That sounds awesome. Good pick.
The book is pretty good, too. I read it for the first time recently because I was like, I'm in a Jaws mood. And there's something that happens in...
Whole different thing.
Something happens in the book I was, like, devastated by.
Yeah.
I was like, this is not in the movie. What are we doing? And yeah, it was just a complete, yeah, like, I think blindside.
One of those
me.
Cases where the movie's better than the book. I just left me flat.
Rarely, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the movie is... Well, I mean, Spielberg doesn't love sex scenes and that sort of thing. This isn't a common topic on TGN. The book goes in an entirely different direction almost immediately. I remember being in like grade 7, seeing it on the shelf, grabbing it. My dad being like, you know what? let's go with a Thomas Harris or a Jason Bourne or something. I was like, all right, sure.
Yeah, it blindsided me a little bit for sure.
All right, James, why don't you take number two? All three of us have things to watch, so yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so, you know, we're between film club episodes, and I feel like every time I watch a movie now, I'm kind of assessing, will this make the film club? I spoke about Midnight Run a few episodes back, and if you haven't watched that, do it this weekend. Incredible film. But one that I watched kind of at the behest of my brothers that I just kind of missed, like totally went over my head, is a movie called Black Bag. It's now back on Amazon Prime, so if you have Amazon, you can find it there. I saw it in a couple other spots for a few bucks if you just want to rent it. So this is a spy thriller, but very tight, very small, almost at moments like with a level of like Hitchcock brilliance to certain sequences. I would say it's weirdly edited, and I think if you watch this, the pacing, you might realize this. The ending kind of comes out of nowhere. There are moments that are jaw-dropping in this movie, and it's Fassbender, you know, an absolute TGN fave, and Cate Blanchett, also a TGN fave. It's just a really, really good cast. And then it's Steven Soderbergh. So if you've ever seen Ocean's 11, 12, 13, that's kind of the slick Soderbergh. You get the really cerebral Soderbergh with things like Syriana and Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, or the somewhat slept on, but I think largely appreciated, Michael Clayton. If you like any of those and you want all of that kind of, especially those last three, but tuned towards like spies spying on each other sort of film, I think they could have presented this as Never Leaving. Please watch it and then you'll understand what I mean. And Jason, I know you've watched this. Neil, I don't know if you have.
It's on my list.
Watch this and then you might understand. There's a version of this where they could have told the entire story without leaving the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been, it would have felt more like Rope, one of my absolute favorites, my favorite Hitchcock.
Love Rope.
Incredible film. And this movie had that sharp, almost terrifying edge to it at times. It's just really good. It's not wall-to-wall an A+, but there are moments of it that are so good that it covers up some of the other stuff.
Yeah, it was good. And it reminds me, like your mention of being able to do it without leaving the dinner table, like it felt like it could have been a play. You know, it just had that sort of good dialogue.
Fassbender.
Very cerebral. Yeah, yeah.
Not good. Playing Martian.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a whole different vibe that he's pulling in there. And I'm never upset to see Blanchett, especially in like a powerful role.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. I highly recommend it. A solid spy thriller that doesn't feel like...
Like it's trying to be...
You know, it's not a Bond.
Yeah.
Right? It's closer to a Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Yeah. That one's going to be hard to beat. Mm-hmm. Let's be clear. That's the A+, cream of the crop. But this is really solid stuff. And I just love seeing Soderbergh make movies that, you know, continue to kind of explore other spaces with his level of slickness. And the cinematography is ridiculous. The architecture is amazing. Everything's great. Yeah. pretty fun.
Cool.
All right. Well, I'm going to close it out with another movie recommendation. This is also a documentary bookending with Neil's choice. This one's called Becoming Led Zeppelin, and it's on Apple TV. You know, rockumentary, kind of a behind the music-esque sort of thing. And it's in that genre. If you've seen these kind of movies, you know exactly what they're like. Lots of interviews with old rockers kind of recounting their glory days and how things started, and some really great archival footage. And I think that was my favorite part, is like seeing Jimmy Page playing. I didn't realize that both he and John Paul Jones, the bassist for Led Zeppelin, both played on the theme song for Goldfinger behind Shirley Bassey. Like, they were in that orchestra. It's just like one of these kind of weird little trivia pieces that came out of that movie. And it was good. I mean, I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan, and I think this probably is a little bit watered down, felt a little bit like might have been sanitized a bit, you know, getting rid of some of the sex and drugs part of the rock and roll stuff, which is fine because it was really focused a lot on the music, and it was just great to like hear them. They just let them play full songs. Like, a lot of times documentaries, they just play snippets and then they cut away, but this one, like, they kind of went on with it. So if you're a Zeppelin fan, check that out. I think
it's really cool.
I think between our final notes here, I think we got a pretty solid trio. We've got, you know, kind of a cerebral spy thriller and two documentaries, one about Jaws and one about Zeppelin.
So cool.
Jason, I'm curious, what's your favorite Zeppelin album? Do you have a fave? So many albums.
Yeah. I think Led Zeppelin 4, I think, stands out. I mean, everything from the cover art to the story behind the recording of it. You know, I kind of feel like they reached their peak with that one before they kind of got further along into the 70s and started making some new stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's just all so good.
Yeah,
like, just pick like the best of album and just go through them. And I think some of even the songs that everybody knows, you know, like, a lot of times there'll be a popular song that is good for a reason and everybody likes it, but when it comes on, you're kind of like, okay, I've heard this so many times, I don't want to listen to it anymore. Like, if I hear Stairway to Heaven, yeah, like, I'll listen to it full, all the way through, all the way up, volume all the way up. Like, it's just, that song never gets old. And that's the case with almost every Zeppelin song. They knew how to jam, which I loved.
Yeah. I watched a guy on Instagram play Comfortably Numb, which is probably my favorite guitar solo of all time. Pink Floyd on a lute, I think it was. And it was like a medieval. And it was gorgeous. Wow, it was like, awesome. Like, okay. Sarah even saw what she was doing. She's all like, right. Doesn't know. I don't think she knows the guitar solo from Comfortably Numb. But that one's great. Yeah, for me, Zeppelin's probably Zeppelin 3. Mm. Friends is such a song.
Yeah. Yeah,
such a big fan of that, and Tangerine will never kind of lose its luster for me. Neil, are you much of a Zeppelin fan?
You know, music is like my crux here. I'm a little bit naive on some music stuff, so I probably know songs if I hear them, but I couldn't tell you names and albums.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, these are also, you know, pretty old albums. Yeah. If you didn't grow up with, like, in my case, with like a classic rock dad and that sort of thing, then you don't necessarily. To be fair, my father's not a huge Zeppelin fan. That came to me probably through my brother, actually, who is obsessed with Four and remains obsessed with Four for sure. Great stuff. Some really good stuff to check out there. And yeah, if you don't know the albums, go back and listen to 3 and 4, and then watch the doc. I didn't think you'd let down.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, this has been super fun.
This is awesome.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
What an absolute treat.
Yeah. This will be our second in a row with a really fun and great guest. So, Neil, thanks for joining us. You're going to close us out with a quote. But before that, as always, thanks to everyone for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout a siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote. A gentleman's choice of timepiece is as much about him as does his Savile Row suit. Ian Fleming.